Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Kevin Beckett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Mackey.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yep.
Yes, you're indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And as usual, we've got a great guest lined up for you. And we also have a couple of topics under discussion. But first of all, I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
John, good to be back. And our yes. special guest on this show is Olympic gold medalist Kate Richardson-Walsh. And she's not actually talking predominantly about hockey. What we're going to be talking about is the... I suppose the situation of being a gay athlete at the highest level and some of the abuse and the problems that you're faced with that proposition, because there was a lot of trolling against some of the gay athletes at the Women's Football World Cup, which I found disappointing and disturbing. And so I wanted to speak to somebody who had been in that situation, because obviously I don't know anything about that. And obviously Kate Richardson-Walsh and her wife Helen were the first same-sex couple, married couple, to win an Olympic gold medal and to play an Olympic final. So I thought they would probably know better than anybody the abuse or the sort of problems that that situation brings with your relationship.
I must admit, I'm a little bit staggered that we have to, that we find ourselves discussing a topic like this, but we need to.
Yeah, I agree, John. I think it's very sad that we have to, in that I thought the world had moved on. You know, we've allowed gay marriage now and we've accepted it. So what is the problem? To me, when you play sport, as long as the guys in the changing room around you or the girls around the changing room alongside you can do their job, who cares what their, you know, sexual relationships are, what the color of their skin is, or what religion they are? I don't care.
We should save that discussion for later, though.
We should indeed, but you wanted to start us off.
Ashes.
There's some cricket happening.
Ashes. Well, shades of 1989. This Australian team was in disarray. They were going to be thrashed by the World Cup winning English. Didn't turn out that way, did it?
No, and I don't think they were ever going to be thrashed, to be honest. With Justin Langer in charge, I think he knew exactly what he was doing. And I did read something in one of the British press where they were saying they reckoned actually this was one of the best prepared teams on English wickets to actually go to England for a long time. So Justin Langer, I think, has realised that, OK, you're not having those county games, but we're going to have, you know, they have that inter-squad game, which would have gone a long way to helping them prepare. As for England being world beaters, I'm sorry... Jimmy Anderson, he may be England's greatest bowler in terms of the wickets he's taken. He may be a great bowler in England, but seriously, is he still trundling out there? And now, you know, he broke down in that test. I didn't think he bowled particularly well before he did get injured. Stuart Broad, I give him his credit, bowled well, but I just think they've got to start bringing through new bowlers or they're going to get absolutely thrashed in this series, in my opinion.
Yeah, probably age is working against Jimmy Anderson now. I mean, what, he's got a calf?
Yeah,
the old man's injury. Once you start doing those sort of, especially in a fast bowler, those sorts of muscle injuries, I mean, it's not something that can be fixed by surgery necessarily. It's just, you're going to carry that for the rest of your life, not just career, for life you're going to have issues with your calf.
Yeah, but look, I mean, Australia thoroughly deserved, and Steve Smith, two fantastic innings from him. And you know, here's a guy that he loves cricket. There is no doubt about it. And I think he's come back, as I wrote on the blog, I think he wants to now make up for the mistake he made, which he's taken responsibility for. We still don't know how involved he was with that, which, you know, I don't think we ever will know until maybe he writes his autobiography. But, to me, I think he's come back and he's going, I want to make up for that mistake, because he loves the game so much.
Oh, yeah.
And I think he just wants to now be the best batsman he ever can be and score as many runs as he can and entertain the fans. And I wish him good luck.
Is captaincy still out of the question? I mean, many people were saying at the time never to captain again regardless.
I don't think he should. I mean, personally, I don't think he was ever... To me, the situation that arose showed that he lacked the maturity to be a captain with the characters that he had in the team. I don't think he necessarily could control some of them. And this is where I don't think Australia's made the best decisions, always making the best player captain. Hopefully now they will have maybe learnt and things will have evolved. But I would just let him play cricket.
Yeah.
Let him be an advisor or a vice captain, but don't give him that burden of responsibility, because it's just going to open the can of worms again.
Now, as much as it's been about Steve Smith in the first test, and you can't take that away, his performance was outstanding. 8 for 122, and they win the test by 250 runs. It wasn't just Steve Smith's century, it was Nathan Lyon's bowling as well, especially on that last day. And you may remember on this podcast, well, I think we were still live on air at that time, but it was after the South African test in Adelaide, and Nathan Lyon had all day to bowl to the South Africans. I think it was Faf du Plessis who stonewalled them, essentially, and they got away with a draw in that test. And I said at the time, look, I'm not, you know, Nathan Lyon is a good, honest cricketer and rah, rah, but, you know, it was set up for him and he should have done this and blah, blah. Well, how wrong am I?
Well, John, I'm going to join that apologist as well, because never rated him, to be honest, as a great off-spin bowler. Again, I got in an argument with an Australian who works for one of the TV stations up in Asia. And we had this argument when we were working at the Southeast Asian Games. And I said, oh, you know, I don't think he's that great. He's going, no, he's got to be amongst the best spin off-spin bowlers ever. And I was like, come on, no, seriously. But you know what? I still stand by that. I don't think he's the greatest spinner of a ball, but I think he's one of the smartest off-spin bowlers you'll come across, in that he is so in the game in terms of what he thinks and how he thinks batsmen out. And that's, to me, where he is a really, really class performer.
And his record will show at the end of the day he will be one of the greatest off-spinners to have ever played the game, purely on wickets and statistical stuff that... I don't rate him as the greatest spinner I've ever seen. I think there's plenty of spinners that rate above him as far as you go to the game and you watch them. But the way he thinks about the game and the way he approaches different batsmen, he's a very, very clever cricketer. Very clever.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more.
He outthought just about every wicket he takes. He outthinks the batsman. Now, Warne was good at that. He could outthink batsmen, but he had all the tricks in the bag. Nathan Lyon doesn't have half of the tricks that Shane Warne did, yet look at his performances. They're outstanding. Over a long period of time now, took him a while to get going and get in the groove of it. I don't have enough superlatives. I think he's just, especially when you write someone off and you see them to come back the way he does over a long period of time, he's a fantastic cricket player.
Now, and I think now, as you touched on there, I think he has the psychological upper hand, very much like Warne. I think when he comes on to bowl now, there are a lot of batsmen go, oh, hell, I've got to really concentrate. I think he's actually got the upper hand with a few batsmen now, and I think he could be the turning point in the series from the bowlers for Australia. I know everyone's talking about Cummins, Stark, Pattinson, but I think Lyon could be the key.
Well, a lot of the talk before the tours about Australia's quicks and Anderson and Broad, and they were going to juice the wickets up, etc., etc. It's one of the... I think it'll probably be the driest wickets we've ever seen in an Ashes test. They've never had weather like this in England. It's been very hot in Europe, and I think you'll find some of these... If that trend continues with the weather, a lot of these pitches will start drying up really quick, and he's going to come into his own. It wouldn't surprise me to see Australia putting England in at some stages, Australia batting on pitches that they maybe shouldn't bat first on, just so that they get Lyon bowling at the end of the test. Because I don't think we've ever seen conditions like this for an Ashes tour. I don't think we've ever, you know, maybe in the future they'll be worse. Who knows what happens with global warming, etc. Not going there, but, I'm not so sure that the experts read the conditions as well as they could have.
No, I think the question for England is, can they bowl Australia out twice, you know, quickly enough to get a victory in this series? And I don't think with the bowling attack they had in this test, even if Anderson had been fit, they did.
Yeah, it's interesting that Jofra Archer overnight has taken wickets and made runs in a practice game. you know, they're obviously going to rush him back in. I can't see them leaving him
out. And it's unfortunate that Mark Wood, you know, has had an operation after the World Cup, so he's not going to be unavailable, because he's genuinely quick. And, you know, one of the few bowlers in the world that is genuinely quick. But probably before we wrap up the cricket, also just want to say one bowler who I think was head and shoulders probably the best fast bowler in world cricket announced his retirement in the last week, and that's Dale Steyn. And to me, in a world where the bowling has been pretty ordinary, he was a standout. And I mean, just to put that, he took wickets wherever he played. Yeah. And that's why, for people who get on my back because I criticised Jimmy Anderson, Jimmy Anderson has only taken 5 wickets overseas once. And to me, if you're a world-class bowler, you take wickets wherever you play. And Dale Steyn was a world-class bowler.
No doubt there. Very good.
Hi, I'm Derek Underwood, and this is the Not the Footy Show.
Good choice, John. He was a pretty special spin bowler.
He knew how to get him down, yeah.
And he didn't bowl that slow either.
No, he wasn't as slow. He could probably drop a bouncer on you.
Well, there's that famous picture when he got bounced, wasn't it?
Yeah. You know,
he's in the air and ducking, swaying out of the way.
Before we move on, we had watching it. Pat Cummins was out to bat, and someone said, the English bowler, I can't remember who it is, came in, bowled him a short pitch one, and the commentator, oh, the traditional short pitch to bowler, you know, welcome to a fast bowler thing. Pat Cummins is the last fast bowler in the world that you bowl a bouncer to. He looks at that go past and goes, you keep them coming, mate, no problems at all. Pat Cummins is a very technical, he works very hard at his batting, and he's very technically correct. I don't think he's a great batsman, but he works so hard at it. He's not going to be bothered by that short pitch stuff. Not like Stuart Broad is.
Nah. But anyway, we've got to get on to our guest. And as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, our guest on this show is the Olympic gold medalist and former Great Britain captain at the Rio Olympic Games, and also part of the first same-sex couple to play an Olympic gold medal match in hockey and at the Olympics, and it is Kate Richardson-Walsh. And we're going to talk about the problems or the situation of being a gay person playing top flight sport. Kate Richardson-Walsh, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Hello, how are you, Ash?
I'm very good, thanks. It's good to catch up with you, even though we're on opposite sides of the world.
Yeah, I'm having lunch, you're having dinner. It's all sorted.
Absolutely. Now, obviously the reason I wanted to talk to you is because I think you've been in a fairly unique situation, as obviously you and Helen were the first same-sex married couple to win an Olympic gold medal. And I'm sure the journey that you've been on together at times has not been easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think initially it was particularly hard. For everybody, to be honest. I think anybody that into a same-sex relationship will come across some challenges, and I don't think those challenges stop at the beginning. I think they continue throughout your whole life. I think lots of gay people have said you basically come out almost every day of your life, and sometimes that can take its toll, and sometimes that's absolutely fine, and it's people are really good with you and comfortable with the situation, and other times it doesn't sit well with them, and sometimes they'll let you know that, and that can be really challenging.
I'm sure it is. I mean, as somebody that's played a fair amount of sport, I mean, I look at it and I think, you know, when I was a child, that there were obviously women sport didn't get much coverage on TV then. You sort of saw women doing athletics, swimming, tennis, golf, hockey every 4 years at the Olympics. You never really saw them playing cricket, football or rugby, which are obviously now televised. But I was amazed that, you know, all those years ago, yes, there was always that thing. And it was, they put women's sport down saying that obviously you had to be gay if you played sport and you were a woman. And I'm amazed that in this day and age that still those sort of archaic views are still around. I mean, are you amazed that they're still there as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just steeped in the traditions of sport. And I think historically and traditionally, sport was seen to be for men. And then I think as, this is years and years and years ago, as women started to play, I think they were then seen as masculine, masculinized. So they seemed they came across as masculine, and therefore if you're a woman and you're masculine, you must be then gay. And I think, I know growing up, I was kind of born in 1980, and I definitely sensed some of it, kind of watching the, as you say, tennis, the Olympics every 4 years that I got to see on TV. I definitely got a little bit of a sense of that. But for me, most importantly, I grew up around my mum's hockey team, and that had all different kinds of women. And so I feel really blessed that actually I did get to experience just life in all of its breadth, and all those different role models that I had growing up. And I think then we went through a phase then when I started playing hockey, I think socially and in sport internationally, there was a shift, a real shift, and probably in society as well outside of sport, that women then almost wanted to take a hold of the situation and how they were being viewed and how they were being portrayed as athletic women. So then it became quite sexualized, I think, female athletes, sometimes overtly, sometimes very much over the top, in my opinion. I did my dissertation many, many moons ago on the sexualization of female athletes, because it was something I really noticed, and I found it really interesting. You know, why is that? Why do lots of female athletes and media and broadcasters and governing bodies, to be fair, really feel the need to do that? And I think it was for lots of those people, it was a need to come away from that traditional masculine version of what a female athlete looks like. And then I kind of feel like now we're just about getting to the point where we've got a whole range of women who play sport, and you can be different sexuality, you can be different religion, different background, different skin colour, different age, different in every sense. And that's where I think we need to be. And hopefully that is where we'll go.
No, I think you're right. I mean, the thing I find amazing, and you touched on that, and I had it written down, that, you know, in all the change rooms that I've ever played sport, I've never really given a damn what the person's sexuality is, what religion they are, the colour of their skin. The key thing was, could they play, and were they a member of the team, and were they going to help us win? That was all you really worried about. And so I find it really strange that people seem so hung up on these issues, and they don't just look at the sporting context. And to me, that is the beauty of sport, is you can be all shapes and sizes and all colours, all religions, and it brings you together. Isn't that what it's all about, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think sport can just break down so many of those barriers. However, it isn't good in and of itself. You know, it isn't going to do all of those things. And not every scenario for every person, unfortunately, is a positive one. And I think we have to recognise that. Because if we don't, if we kind of blinker ourselves and just think, oh, it's fine, I had a good experience, it must be fine, and I think we're missing a lot of people, and we're not helping the situation. I think people still face so much discrimination, particularly I think homophobia and racism, as we've seen in male sport, particularly over the last season, in football in particular.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I was flabbergasted when we saw some of the trolling that happened during the Women's FIFA World Cup to the gay players there. And I mean, it, obviously I've never suffered something like that, so I don't know how it would feel. But did you and Helen suffer that? And how did it feel? And how do you get over it? And how do you combat it?
I mean, I think we've been very, very lucky. And I mean, I say lucky in that we haven't had very much trolling. We haven't had that much negativity. I do question sometimes why that might be, because I know other female athletes, and as you said, the Women's World Cup, I think it's a good example, get far, far worse. I mean, the hockey public okay is smaller. But it's that interests me. Is it how we're viewed? Is it what we look like? Is it how we talk about our relationship in the media? Or, you know, we're quite private, we're happy to talk about it, but we don't kind of put it in front of people all of the time. You know, does that make us more palatable? Does that mean therefore it rubs people up the wrong way less? I don't know. I think that's quite an interesting thing to explore. But we've had we get tweets down again, and we had some hate mail, particularly after Rio, because we're in front of a bigger audience and it's a non-hockey audience. And, you know, that's hard. It's when someone's telling you that you're wrong and you're going to go to hell and you've brought shame on your family and your country, you know, that's hard to take. And if it's just one, that's, you know, enough to hurt, frankly. And yeah, you can screw it up and throw it in the bin, and you can ask your social media outlets to block these people and you report them, but it still doesn't hurt any less to be made to feel like you're other, that you're wrong because of who you love, is just very challenging to deal with.
No, I'm sure it must be. As I say, I can't imagine what it must be like in that situation. I mean, one thing that I wanted to ask as well was, I'm not sure if you saw it, Megan Rapinoe, you know, from the US women's team, she came out with the statement, you can't win a championship without gays on your side. Did that, do you think that, you were just saying there, do we talk about it? Do comments like that help the cause? Or could, do you think maybe that damaged the sort of situation? Because certainly I know a lot of women I spoke to found that that was maybe almost disrespectful to heterosexual players in the team.
I think Megan Rapinoe, I think, used her platform that she's created for herself and her status to make some statements. And I think she's been making statements for a long time about race and sexuality in particular, but discrimination across the board. And I think she, in doing kind of that kind of comment, in, I think is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, actually, but I also think it's starting conversation. And I think sometimes you need to be made to feel uncomfortable to really have a good, long, hard look at your biases and the reality of the situation for what she considers for her and the people in her community face every day. And I think the way the media works, the way the world works now, it's a bit clickbait, you know, unless you're prepared to just throw something out there to get the conversation started, it will be missed. It will not, you know, it'll just be a tweet that gets lost and nobody cares. And I think she has grabbed the headlines, and I think you can disagree or agree with her point and what she said, but actually what it's done is start a conversation, which is exactly, I believe, what she wants. Because in order for us to have tolerance and understanding of each other and our differences, we have to have a conversation about it. And so I think that's what she started, personally.
Well, we're doing exactly that. And you were saying just earlier in this interview, how do we start those conversations? So if that is what she was aiming to do, then she's done a damn fine job of it.
Yeah. And, you know, I think Colin Kaepernick in the NFL for the San Francisco 49ers, it was one of the first players to take a knee during the national anthem, the US national anthem. And it takes that punchy, high level,
courage.
Action and it is that real courage. Courage of your convictions, courage of your values, of your belief system. And to back it up with actions and get people talking. And then I think both of them, I think, have then started to work out, okay, how can I help? What can we do? It's not just that I'm going to just go do this thing and just, you know, everyone else get on with it. I think they're trying to be part of the solution as well.
One thing I think that's unique about your situation and is probably the fact that, you know, you were in a relationship in the same team, you know, you were teammates, you were key components of that team as well. And it was interesting, you know, that leading up before Rio, the 2014 World Cup, Helen was out injured. She didn't make the squad for the World Cup. And I would have thought that was really difficult for you because not only were you captain of the team, you probably wanted her there as a player and also as your partner, and she wasn't there. Did you find that was probably the most tricky part of your whole captaincy at that time?
Yeah, I'd say the beginning of our relationship was pretty tricky to navigate. But then I'd say, yeah, oh, I don't know, there's loads of tricky things. But yeah, that was hard in terms of our relationship. You know, it wasn't, my sister used to also play in the national team. You know, that wasn't particularly easy when my sister's playing in the national team and I was captain, because you find yourself caught, you know, I'm professional and they know that and all the players know that and the coaches know that. So I'm Kate and I'm the captain of the team and that is my first and foremost job, and I'm a player who's trying to get selected and then trying to help everybody else do the same. But then you're also, that's your sister, and that's also then Helen was my wife. And then, you know, sometimes that can put you in more challenging situations or thought places where you have to really think and consider your position. And that was hard because I just wanted to support Helen. She was in so much pain physically and then so much pain mentally. But I had to carry on with my job, and she knew that and she supported me in that. But then it was a really terrible kind of time for the team. And so we were all struggling. I think that year of 2014 is just the year of hell. And in every sense, I think we all just couldn't wait for it to end and then get cracking with a new era.
I think one of the things I found in an interview you did prior to the Olympics, you were saying though that having Helen in the team, you were a little bit more direct with her or she was direct with you when you were in training situations. And you said sometimes, you know, you had to make sure that those frustrations finished at the training ground and didn't carry over when you got home.
Yeah, I think you're always harsh with the people that you know the best. It's exactly the same. My sister was in the team. We would talk to each other. You know, just you wouldn't speak to anybody else like that in the team. But because you know that person so well, you take away lots of filters, and it just comes out in the way that it's in your head, for, you know, rightly or wrongly. And probably if I could go back in time, I'd probably not do that. But it's just your subconscious, and it just comes out. And so I think it was the same with Helen and I. And yeah, we were so ridiculously professional. We were so professional at hockey, but then I guess that just spilled out into our home life. We almost lost a bit of what we were like as a couple, because we were so hell bent on being professional and just being Kate and Helen, two separate players, two separate brains, here to do a professional job, and to not have our relationship impact on the team in any way at all.
No, it must have been very hard. I mean, there's a question I've got for you, and you can tell me to mind my own business if you want. But, I mean, I've spoken to coaches of female teams, be they male or female coaches, and they've said sometimes, even with men's teams, it's a tricky situation working out who's going to room with who. Now, I mean, how did that work? I mean, were you able to share a room together as a married couple? And what was the reaction from the rest of the team if you were allowed to? Because obviously some of them weren't allowed to be with their partners.
Yeah, so, I mean, that again goes into us just being hockey players. And I think the greatest thing about this is, I think, how Danny dealt with us as a couple and us and the situation, I guess, in the team. He was just brilliant and just talked to us. And we just had some brilliant conversations right from the off, exactly about that. You know, what were his fears, what were our fears, what were potentially some of the ramifications with the team. And we just talked about them. And we kind of constantly talked about them. And we had, throughout all of our training and all of our trips, for any trips, you would be put in a room with anybody. So you could just be put in a room with anybody in the team, and that's as it was. For Helen and I, the same as everybody else in the team. But for tournaments, everybody in the team got to choose. I think you could choose three people who you'd like to room with. And then the management would try and kind of figure that out logistically, how that works. So try and make sure everybody gets to be in a room with somebody that's in their top three or whatever, which was a logistical nightmare. But, you know, and it didn't always work out exactly as people wanted it. And, of course, not everybody can have their number one pick. But we were just part of that. So, you know, they were great friends in the team, as well as Helen and I. There were some really close friendships in the team, and people who would absolutely want to room with that person. And they weren't in a relationship, but they were just great roommates and helped each other through the tournament. And so, in a way, that's exactly as it was for Helen and I, even though we were in a relationship. It was effectively the same thing. And I think we we were really open to talking to players about it. If they had problems, they could go to directly to Danny. You know, we were more than happy to have conversations about it. And I think we both felt really fortunate in that, and were really thankful that Danny, I think, just handled the whole situation really, really well.
It sounds like, you know, you've almost been this role model couple, not just as hockey players, but also as a relationship. And I'm sure at times, though, as you touched on there, that it's been kind of hard because you were so focused on your hockey careers and doing the right thing as players that you actually said this, that sometimes maybe you sacrificed a bit of your relationship. Now you're both retired. Are you able to actually enjoy that side of your relationship a bit more?
Yeah, and that's been really nice, just being able to be Kate and Helen, and we don't have to think about, oh, we can't be this now, we can't be in a relationship here, we're Kate and Helen, separate people, hockey players, we can just be and just spend time together and build a life outside of hockey, because that's all we've known for a long time. In 17 years we were in the team, and then we were together for, you know, a good period of that towards the end. So it's been really, really good to come out of that. I mean, that's been one of the positive things from retiring from the hockey team.
Just one final question, because again, one of the things to come out of the FIFA Women's World Cup was we heard the players saying there that they wanted their tournament to run at the same time as the men's tournament, as well as obviously equal pay. Now, we know hockey, there is no sort of pay really in the game there, but you participated in World Cups that were separate. You also participated in 2014 where the World Cups ran parallel to each other. And we've seen with the FIH Pro League that, you know, the men and women have played together. Do you think that is a good idea, or which did you prefer as a player, having the tournaments together or having them separate?
I mean, the first thing I'd say is that I think there is inequality in pay in hockey, and not in terms, not at government governing body level, but I think in terms of sponsorship and opportunity, men versus women, I think men have far more opportunity and therefore greater sponsorship deals. So I think that, I want to say that first and foremost. And then, but secondly, to your question, I think it's good to have them together. I think that's a unique thing that our sport has. I don't think every sport necessarily is the same, and I don't think it might be the right option for every sport. But I think for our sport, I think it works nicely when they're together, because at that international level, in terms of how the sports at international level are pitched, advertised, supported, I think that is equal, and that's a nice thing about our sport that I think we should continue to promote. So I think if we can have it together, I mean, logistically, I know that's incredibly hard and it may rule out certain places in terms of hosting, but I think it's a nice thing that we can do.
No, I certainly enjoy it, I must admit. Well, it's been wonderful catching up with you again, and thank you for being so candid. And let's just hope, as you touched on several times, you know, in our conversation, that there are more conversations, that people do talk more. And I want to just congratulate you and Helen for obviously doing so much talking about your relationship and getting people talking about it and accepting it far more, because I'm sure that's taken a great deal of courage and also a little bit of a toll on both your lives as well.
No, thanks, Sam. I really appreciate it. It's really good chatting to you. And yeah, if it helps one person be comfortable in their own skin, or it helps somebody help someone in their club or at their school, you know, feel more comfortable in themselves, then we've, you know, done a good job.
No, absolutely. And thanks again for your time.
No worries. Thanks, Ash.
Hello, my name is Joe Cortez, international boxing referee from Las Vegas, Nevada, the boxing capital of the world. Listen to Not the Footy Show. It's a knockout. Check it out.
Thanks very much, Joe. Always love that recommendation by him.
Yes. What do you make of Kate's words?
Oh, look, I think she talks a lot of sense, and as you would expect. To me, it is very sad that we still have this minority group that feel that they need to abuse female athletes who are gay. And let's be honest, there are some who abuse male athletes who are gay. And I don't think that any gay person in the sporting world now should be ashamed of coming out. I think they should feel quite comfortable, as long as obviously they feel that that is how they are in their real life. They shouldn't have to hide it just because they're an athlete. And they shouldn't have to cop abuse either, John. I mean, to me, it's about what they do on the sporting field and how they perform. And that is what they should be judged on.
Yeah, I can't say I've ever had a problem with it. I can't say I would have known. I can't say that I would have cared. For me, it's just staggering. The whole thing about being in a sporting team is diversity, and you bring together a group of disparate people and they achieve something together. Now,
100% agree with
I play hockey with guys that have vastly different views on politics, on religion, on all sorts of subjects. So why should I care if one of those differences is being gay?
Yeah. But that's the thing, you accept those differences for the common purpose of the sport you're playing and what you're trying to achieve. And there'll be people, I'm sure, John, that you play with in your team that you don't particularly like. You know, I've played with some people I couldn't stand, but then you get in the change rooms and there's a common purpose. And where you put those differences aside and you just go out there and you work. And yes, I'd go up to them, congratulate them if they succeeded, if they scored a goal, scored a try, scored 50, took a wicket, because we were doing it as a team. And you put those differences aside. Outside of the pitch, did I want to have a beer with them and go and socialise? No, but that's life.
I think if you hang around, you have a beer with your teammates after the game, that's all that should be expected of you. You're not expected to live your life along other people's, you know, whatever that word is that I'm looking for. I struggle with the whole thing. I mean, then you've got something like, as we've had in this country, the Israel Folau situation, where he has personal views that I don't necessarily agree with, but I don't think he should be pilloried for having those views necessarily. They're his views. That's the way he feels. That's for him and his teammates to decide, and it appears that they have, and he's not welcome anymore.
Yeah, and that to me exactly is the way it should have been handled. His teammates should have said, look, either they were prepared to accept his views and maybe say to him, look, tone them down if you're, you know, because we're getting copped for it as well, and you need to take that into consideration as we're part of the same team.
Yeah, and I don't think you can just dismiss his views. He has, I would suggest, reasonable grounds for holding those views. That's his religious belief. And remember, we're talking beliefs here. We're not talking fact. You want to believe that, mate? That's fine. Believe that. I'm not going to stop you. There's nothing I can do from stopping you believing that. But it doesn't mean that you have to go around sprouting off and upsetting people with your particular views. And if you're representing a national team, I think that it's incumbent on you to represent everybody. Finish your career, go off and do your ministering stuff, you know, turn gay people into the axis of evil if you like, but not while you're a representative of a nation. That's probably pushing the barrow a bit too far.
But I think this is one of the things, and somebody said it, I thought put it really well during the whole Israel Folau thing. It's saying it's okay to have personal beliefs or even personal opinions, but there is a responsibility as an individual as to how you air those and where you air those. Yeah. And I think that is very, very true. And I think that's the sad thing with this whole social media vortex that we have today, is there are a lot of people who will say things, they'll throw this comment out, sometimes just to get a reaction. And there's not that responsibility. And I would like to see us as a society suddenly start turning on this and saying, no, that's not acceptable. If you want to say it, there needs to be more responsibility in that space.
Does it cut the other way? We've seen the situation in the United States where the Women's World Cup team are refusing to meet the president. Now, they say they're refusing to meet Donald Trump, but they're refusing to meet the president because while you're president, you're not John F. Kennedy or Abraham Lincoln. You're the president of the United States. And I felt very uncomfortable with them dismissing the president in such a way. You've got different views, that's fine. Guess what? You've probably got different political views. You've probably got different views from anybody that could have been in that position. but it's the president and you're the American team and you should honour that. Now, come out later on and say, I don't like the guy as a prodder. Many people think that, but that's the person, Donald Trump. That's not the position, the president.
Well, there's a prime example of that was, and I think it was Paul Keating who wanted a republic, didn't he? He wanted to break away. And the Queen made a visit to Australia. And he, even though he wanted a republic, felt it was his duty as our representative, the Prime Minister, to meet Her Majesty the Queen. And I think that's flipping it the other way. But I agree with you. I think it's the office, not the individual.
Yeah. And so there's lots of little minute little arguments all through this whole thing. You know what? If no one cared, it wouldn't matter. So stop caring, everybody. Just stop caring.
Okay, we should probably move on to another subject because we could go on about this forever. But my topic, John, I just want to touch on, because we've had Kate Richardson Walsh, there's a lot of debate going on around the world, and I know you guys have talked about it on the reverse stick as well, and that is the FIH World Rankings. So that's the International Hockey Federation's World Rankings. Now, they're talking they're going to change it. They're definitely going to change it. The thing that concerns me about this is that there's a lot of things. First of all, what concerns me is the competitions committee are all flying to Lausanne to discuss this. Now, hockey at the moment, there is no money slashing around. The FIH have said they have no money. That is the quote from one of their staff. So why would you fly all these people to Lausanne? There's eight people on the competitions committee. They're coming from all of the regions around the world. So we've got the secretary is coming from Trinidad and so it's at the FIH. The chair is from Trinidad and Tobago. We've got someone from the USA, someone from Singapore, someone from Sweden, Australia, and another from the USA. Now, the other concern I have is the people, and this is nothing against them as individuals, but we have five of them have been involved in the umpiring and the technical side of the game. So I think there's a skew too much that way. The other thing is, if you look at it, Kate Richardson Walsh, who we just had on the show, happens to be the only member of that committee that is under 40. All of the others are 55 and above. Now, I'm not saying this is an ageist thing, and for anyone who thinks I'm trying to get on it, I'm in that age bracket as well, so I'm discounted straight away. But what I'm trying to say here is we need, on these committees, diversity in terms of age, in terms of the areas in the game that these people come from, in order to spark creativity. That, to me, is the most crucial thing, and what the game needs is a bit of creativity at the moment. Now, I'm going to say a few things, John, about the world ranking situation. To me, one thing that has to happen after the Olympic Games next year, which is when it will come into it, is everybody starts on zero.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It has to go back that every country is on that. Now, they're talking of adapting systems used by other sports. Now, I would just say with that, you have to be very careful, because if you're going to adapt that system, then you have to run your sport the way that is being run as well. So taking, for example, if they were going to use the FIFA system, then you have to go, okay, there have to be then only games when FIFA play, the way FIFA does it. So there are FIFA windows, so there must be international windows for hockey as well. And you need to be very careful with that. I think one of the things that was thrown up, or I read about, was that if you were a higher ranked team and you lose to a lower ranked team, then you get points deducted. Now, that's a very dangerous precedent to set, because what you're going to have is the top teams are going to go, stuff you, I'm not going to play a team if I don't have to, outside the top 20, because there's a chance we might lose and we could be deducted. So I think you're going to have, it's actually going to make this protectionist area at the top worse than it's been already. I think the key thing is there can be no points for invitational tournaments whatsoever, which means there can be no world ranking points for the Pro League if that continues.
I think ranking points should only be given for officially sanctioned and organised FIH events.
Correct.
And that includes, don't give ranking points if Germany decide to come down to Australia and play five tests. That doesn't count, because that's organised between Australia and Germany. They do that. The FIH has nothing to do with it. It should only be, and that would essentially be World Cup qualifiers and Olympic qualifiers. That would be all you could get ranking points for.
Yeah, and I agree with that, because the one issue you have is if you start giving it for test matches, countries like your Fijis, your Thailands, all of that, who can't afford and don't play too many games in a year, how are they ever going to get the chance to get points? They're never going to be able to do that. Whereas if you keep it restricted to those events, and the further you progress, you know, obviously the more points you get, and rightly so. I think anybody that medals in those games should get more medals, more points than the teams that don't.
I mean, look at Ireland, the Irish girls, for instance. Now, before the World Cup, say Australia had been offered an Irish Test series, they probably would have gone, oh yeah, that's all right, we'll pick up some points there. Yet you play them 3 weeks after the World Cup, say, and they're in sparkling form, it's going to turn tits up on you. So teams will be very wary of looking at those lower ranked teams and taking them on, thinking that they're going to get easy points.
No, exactly. And I think, you know, there has to be a cap on how many games teams can play, because it is unfair if you're looking at those teams that have no money or can't travel, like the ones I mentioned in Asia, or, you know, that are looking to try and come up the pecking order if they can. It's a bit unfair if you suddenly have, and let's hypothetically say the Dutch, because we know that they are probably one of the best run organisations. They have more money than everybody else. They could play whoever they wanted, whenever they wanted.
Yeah.
So suddenly they play, say, 35 games a year, and someone down the bottom can only play 2 games a year. There's an imbalance there. Now, okay, those teams playing 2 are probably not going to get in the top 10, but they should be given the opportunity to accumulate the same amount of points.
Yeah, everybody, and points should be worth the same regardless. You shouldn't get less points because you happen to play, you're an Asian team, and you play, you know, or you shouldn't get less points because you play in Africa. Everybody, you play a test match or whatever, however they work it out, an Olympic qualifier, regardless of who you play against, they're the points available, and that's it, and you get those points.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I feel, John, and I feel actually very strongly about this with regards to hockey especially, is, you know, you've got at the moment the Confederation Championships going on,
yep,
and Australia's about to play in Oceania. And again, as you've touched on there, the points are different. But Oceania, Australia and New Zealand, are pretty much guaranteed to come first and second in those. And yet they get the same points as, you know, European teams, where there's a much stronger competition. Now, to me, I think the Confederations are outdated. I don't think we necessarily need them. And I think it's an extra cost level on the administration of the game by having them. I think, yes, you might need somebody within the area to oversee those nations within a region, but I don't think we need the confederations anymore.
I think there's still room for them, but I wouldn't be playing confederation tournaments such as the Euros necessary, or the Oceania Cup. You could spread it across 2 years, and, you know, Australia might play 6 games across 2 years instead of playing 6 games in 2 weeks.
I agree, and that's what I think. Is I think the way travel is now, you know, okay, again, we've said about the poorer nations, it is a problem, but if you can do it now on a global scale, if you spread it out over a period of time and people know the structure of it, and it is like that. Whereas I just think the way it is at the moment, it's, again, it's favouring the better nations.
And just changing the world ranking, the point system, isn't going to stop some of the endemic problems within the system. You've got to actually rejig the whole system, the whole qualifying system, to implement a new point system. You can't just change your point system and have the same sort of qualifying going on. That's not going to work.
No, exactly. And this is why I genuinely have a problem with this competitions committee flying over, because I don't think you're at a stage, because of the points we've just raised, where you're going to be able to make a decision that is the right decision at this point in time. I think there needs to be a lot more discussion, and I don't understand with technology today why that discussion cannot be done via the, you know, internet or the communication tools that we have.
Yep, I agree with your point. Just quickly, how much would a hotel room in Lausanne cost you per night?
I got no
150?
Idea.
150?
I would say more than that.
Aussie dollars?
Oh, I think you'd be paying $300 to $500
a night.
Think. Yeah, I would.
See, you can get a week in Bali for $500. Why not fly them all to Bali? That would immediately save you thousands of dollars just by taking it to Bali, which, if someone said, we're going to have a conference in Bali, you'd be going, yeah, I'll have a pick of that. I'll go there. Lausanne. When are you going to Lausanne? Oh, in the winter. There's lots of ways they could be saving money that they choose not to do. They're, as I've said along many, many times, the only people who make money in our sport, hockey, are administrators. Players don't make any money. Officials don't make any money. It's all administrators. So it's about time some of that administration money dripped down the system a little bit and got to where it's really needed.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.